This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota. After several months, the pandemic continues unabated, with hot spots developing, then ebbing, then reappearing. As we take measured steps to reopen businesses and restore a sense of normalcy, the reality looms that the virus benefits from increased interaction. Science tells us that our current circumstance is problematic, and our best hope is scientific research to develop effective treatments and vaccines. In the meantime, we rely on expert advice to reduce our risk. Dr. Michael Osterholm is an internationally recognized expert in epidemiology. He's the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Today, we'll share an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast as Osterholm talks with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter.
Dr. Osterholm, thank you and welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you. It's my privilege to be with you.
You know, you were one of the clarion voices, along with some others, who predicted that this would come, and yet it didn't seem the world was listening. You spent your career analyzing global health threats, Ebola, SARS, MERS, HIV, and the Spanish flu. Here we are with COVID-19. You say we're only in the second, maybe third inning. I'm wondering if you could tell us about how you're thinking, whether it's a modeling, paints such a grim assessment of where we stand today.
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that, as the world knows, we're dealing with a coronavirus, not an influenza virus. Our previous experience with global pandemics from a respiratory transmitted infectious agent like a flu virus or a coronavirus really has given us some good evidence of what we would expect if it were a flu virus, but not with a coronavirus status. This hasn't happened before. So we're really in uncharted territories in that regard. We recognized early in January, when it was clear that there was substantial person-to-person transmission of this virus in China, that this was going to become a pandemic. And in fact, our center put out a document on January 20th stating as such, in which we also said that it would probably not show up as a global pandemic until the last week of February, first week of March, just because it would be introduced into countries around the world with all the transportation that we see today. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, just as we predicted, the end of February, early March, we started to see the major increases in places such as Iran, Italy, and New York City. Right. Since that time, the virus has continued to transmit around the world. And the question is, where is it going to go next? And we actually put together a document at the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. It's on our website, free of charge. What we know is that about 5 to 7% of the U.S. population has been infected with this virus to date. This virus is not going to slow down its transmission until it gets to 60 or 70% of the population infected, or that immunity occurs because of vaccine. And that means we have a lot more to go in terms of cases. And the question is, how is it going to get to the 60 or 70%? Is it going to be like influenza, where we see waves of illness, you know, big peaks that then give way to troughs that for weeks are almost absent of cases and then come back, or with the second wave? Or is it going to just be something we've not seen before, where we just have a slow burn, or for that matter, kind of in between model, where it has peaks and valleys in different locations over time? And that's the part we just have to be humble right now and say, we don't know what's going to happen.
Right. We've seen really different approaches from country to country, and certainly many global health experts have called the U.S. response disastrous, given the highest death tolls in the world that we've seen. And you've advised presidential administrations, governments around the world on how to prepare for and confront pandemics. If you would, just contrast the U.S. response to the response of other countries, and what should we be doing that we aren't as a country?
Well, it's virtually impossible to compare and contrast other countries because everybody's done a little bit different in their approach. It also matters when you pick it up and where you pick it up. If you find the early cases that occur in a given location, you may have a better chance with testing and contact tracing to help shut down that ongoing transmission. You also have to be in an area where you don't have a substantial amount of traffic occurring between jurisdictions or locations. It's much easier when you're an island like New Zealand or Iceland, where you pick it up early, where you then can have the kind of comprehensive programs. But I think you've seen, even in places like China, where right now we're sitting on top of an exploding outbreak in Beijing. And of course, just a few weeks ago, everybody kept touting China as being the ideal country in terms of response. Mm-hmm. While some of those were very draconian measures to keep people in their homes for weeks and weeks and weeks, it did suppress transmission. Now today, we're saying that, you know, this is kind of a leaky bucket virus. If you have even a small leak in it, it's going to get out. It's going to find people. And so in terms of our country, you know, we were very late to the game. Our testing problems were real. Yeah. We couldn't test and we didn't test. We couldn't get into the world of contact tracing. I think we had a tremendous amount of denial about what was about to happen. We had a lot of even experts saying, oh, it's low risk. You know, at this point, we can go back and read the history of what happened. What we have to do is move forward. I published an article in this month's issue of Foreign Affairs. The first paragraph of that article is taken from the first paragraph of my 2005 foreign affairs paper about why we needed to prepare for a pandemic. What we could have and should have done today is what I'm really worried about is we're not preparing for what's left. Mm-hmm. This pandemic is, as it was noted, is in the earliest innings of this game. And we need to understand we have a lot more to go, and we're not even preparing for that, even mm-hmm. with the warning we're getting.
Let's pull the thread on sort of preparation. In your book, The Deadliest Enemy, you outlined very clearly 9-point battle plan for confronting the pandemic. And short of a vaccine, I'm wondering what federal, state, and local governments should be doing.
Well, I think the challenge we have today is what is the science telling us? Mm-hmm. You know, I unfortunately see many people who are willing to talk to the media with pronouncements about certain things with a great deal of certainty.
Yeah.
You know, is there going to be a summer wave or is there going to be a summer trough? Why are we seeing transmission, for example, today in what is roughly 20 states in the United States where transmission is going up? On the other hand, we have 20 states where, in fact, transmission has been reduced over the last 14 days in terms of new cases. Can you explain to me why that's happening? None of us can. And yet I see people talk with authority about what's causing the cases to be increased. And I sit here and say, as an epidemiologist, you know, the same things are happening in those states where they're continuing to decrease. We have many issues like this that have really been a challenge to come up with. What do we need to do? Now, knowing that we're talking about a respiratory transmitted pathogen largely, it makes perfect sense. Distance, distance, distance is by far the most important thing that we can recommend. Mm-hmm. Well, then how do you distance in such a way that you don't shut down not only the economy, but even kill society? And at the same time, how do you keep hospitals like we're seeing right now in some of these states, which their intensive care units are overflowing? And so I think one of the challenges, we've not had a national agenda. We've not had a national plan. We have lost a lot of the public's willingness to work with us on these issues because one-size-fits-all approaches were taken. And for some counties where there hasn't even been a documented case yet of COVID-19, they're asking, why are we still in lockdown?
Right.
And so I think that the challenge we've had is we've not had that kind of open and I think really necessary discussion, even debate about what are the best things to do right now to actually protect the public.
As you may know, we're very engaged in community health and primary care. We certainly recognize age as a key risk factor. Race and ethnicity have emerged as very significant factors in terms of who survives. Chronic health conditions like diabetes, major factor. Obesity seems to be a major factor. Maybe you could tell us a little more about these risk factors as we collect data from around the United States, but also the world. How should we be calibrating the public health response to include these factors in protecting the public?
Well, the need to include these factors in anything that we do in terms of recommendations is absolutely essential. What we need to do is prevent the cases that are most likely to cause serious illness or death. That's what this has been about, I think, from day one. None of us had an illusion that we could somehow stop this pandemic. It's like trying to stop the wind.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is delay as many case onsets as we can until we hopefully will have an effective and safe vaccine. Our challenge is that almost 40% of the population of age 18 and older today, right, excluding gender,
yeah,
are at some form of increased risk, yeah, for having a serious outcome. Today, the obesity epidemic is converging with this pandemic, creating, I think, a serious challenges for us. If you look at many places in the United States, the most frequently cited underlying health concern among those who are severely ill under the age of 55, it's been obesity.
Yeah.
When you look, though, at the other hand, we have many, many people living today with chronic diseases. That actually is one of the good things that has come out of our healthcare system. Many of the 790,000 Americans who live today with end-stage renal disease wouldn't have been alive and for a 1957 or 68 pandemic. Today they are. And so what we need to understand is that bubbling the at-risk population is not nearly as simple as it may seem to be when you're talking about 40% of the population.
Right.
At the same time, for those who are younger, those who are otherwise healthy, should they be locked up in a sense from participating in everyday life? Now, I would argue that for their health, they are at very low risk relative to those who are older who have underlying health conditions. The one concern I'd have about that, though, is remember, they're still the ones having contact with grandpa and grandma,
yeah,
with other people in the community who are at potentially high risk of having a serious outcome. And so when you think about them becoming infected, it's not just that they become infected about themselves, but do they then serve to transmit to others? Mm-hmm. We don't have a national plan. We don't have a global plan right now for how to best deal with this. And that's the challenge that we face. And we have a lot of runway left to carry. Only 5 to 7% of the U.S. population has been infected with this virus to date. To get to 60 or 70% infection before you just begin to slow down the transmission is remarkable. So I always tell people, think about the fact that this 5 to 7% level, think how much pain, suffering, death, and economic disruptions occurred with that. Imagine what we have left to go.
We're speaking today with Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, renowned epidemiologist. His 2017 book, The Deadliest Enemy, Our War with Killer Germs, predicted exactly the kind of pandemic experience that we're having right now. What's your general view of interventions that we might see, whether it's short-term interventions or the vaccine?
We are hopeful for a vaccine, but we also know hope is not a strategy. In that context, there are now over 120 vaccines that are being considered in a number of different categories of how they might work. We know that coronaviruses can be a challenge and that to develop immunity doesn't mean necessarily it's durable immunity, meaning that if you're an acute case today becoming clinically ill, you recover, but that does it persist? And there's real questions about that. The same thing is true for the vaccine itself. You know, if we get a short-term fix vaccine that might wait a year or two, that could still be a great tool. But it wouldn't solve the kind of problems we'd like to solve by having a vaccine that might protect you for 20, 30, or 40 years. We do have concerns about the potential safety issues related to this vaccine. There was a condition known as antibody-dependent enhancement, where making just a little bit of antibody or having the immune system prime just a little bit may actually mean that when you get infected with the real virus, your outcome is much worse. So where am I at on the vaccines today? I think everything that can be done is being done with these different vaccines to study them. I would urge that we do not take any shortcuts, even though this is a crisis. That will come back, I think, to haunt us. The public won't trust the vaccines. And, you know, a vaccine is just a vaccine. It's vaccination that makes the difference.
Right.
If you got to get it into people before you can really make a difference in terms of the disease itself. You know, I don't think it's a slam dunk. I can't under any condition imagine we'd have a safe and effective vaccine available for use in this country by the end of this year. If it does, I think many people will feel very uncomfortable that it's been rushed. At the same time, we understand we're living in the middle of a horrible, horrible pandemic. And we need to throw whatever we can at it with some relative degree of safety. So I think the vaccine thing is a stay tuned issue. Don't hang on every press release that comes out today about vaccines. I think we've already witnessed how we've tried to, in a sense, inform science through press releases, and I think it's been a failure. We shouldn't do that. We need to get the publications. We need to get the data review out. In terms of drugs, the same thing. Today we're dealing with one, a corticosteroid that has been shown in one study in England that it reduced the morbidity and mortality in people who were on ventilators or receiving oxygen. This is a preliminary study. It's only a press release. We've already seen the challenges of trying to understand science through press releases. We need to get the data to look at this more carefully, and we need to have other senators looking at the same issue. But it surely could be an advantage over, obviously, the number of people dying. One challenge with this drug that hadn't yet really been discussed is that if we do save these people's lives, what does this do to intensive care medicine and, and the actual bed availability? So instead of dying at 6 to 9 days, I now die at, you know, at 18 to 20 days, or I don't die, but it takes me until 18 or 20 days to get out of the ICU. That will only double up the number of people who need ICU beds, which is a challenge in of itself. So, you know, I'm excited by the kinds of activities that are going on with Godspeed. I think that overall, most of them are quite deliberative. They're really working to get the kind of information we need. And I wish I could give you more, except for the very earliest stages of what's happening.
There was some prominent mention that there would not be a second wave. I think you have made it clear you expect this virus to behave like others we've seen throughout history. You advise governments, the National Academy of Medicine, and I think very importantly, our frontline healthcare workforce. And we'd like to ask you, what kind of preparation should we be doing now to be ready for the next wave?
One overriding arching principle that has to be addressed, and that is we must protect our healthcare workers from becoming infected with this virus. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have at least 680 Americans who have worked in healthcare and have died as a result of their COVID infection. We are not doing nearly enough from a PPE standpoint to protect healthcare workers, and that has to be paramount. Right now, we're having a hard time trying to shore up our stockpiles of N95 respirators, gowns, gloves, because they're being consumed almost as fast as they're being produced. But I think if there was one priority, I would put it there. Because as goes the healthcare workers of this country, will go the health of the public. If we can't provide better medical care in our hospitals, because we just don't have the trained, capable people to be there because they're sick themselves or they're dead, that's a horrible, horrible situation to find yourself in. So that's number one. Number two is I think we have to look at just how do you prepare your institution for the kind of care that we might be talking about. I worry that far too many healthcare providers think that we're over the worst, and we have a long ways to go. The third area is we have got to do more with the mental health aspects of providing this care to patients.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is we have had healthcare workers who have gone through anything that might have been seen in a war scene with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And, you know, watching many people a day die under their care. And so I think mental health aspects to our healthcare system is also very important. And then finally, I think just plan for how the community is going to respond or react. I think the public right now, as I said, is in the midst of severe pandemic fatigue. They were already locked up for far too long. Many of them saying, I don't even know anybody who's had COVID-19 yet. Well, I tell them you should be concerned about it, because just 90 days ago, this virus was not even among the top 75 causes of death in the United States. And last month, for a number of those days, it was the number one cause of death in the United States. We have not seen that happen since 1918.
Yeah.
So I say that as a healthcare community, be sensitive to the community itself. Understand when they're afraid, understand when they are concerned, and understand when they feel reassured. And you have to be part of that. We need to get the public straight talk. It needs to be very effectively communicated, and it needs to tell them and healthcare workers, this is step one, two, and three of what you need to do to protect yourself.
We've got a flu season coming up, and nobody seems to be talking about that. You know, if it was 1957 or 1967, all which were flu seasons where we lost about 100,000 lives in it, we're going to have to figure out how to both deal with the COVID virus, but also how are we going to give immunizations out to all the hundreds of millions of people who need it. What's your thinking about the two maybe converging around the same time that there's might be a second wave?
My colleague, Dr. Ed Belanger, and I actually published an editorial in Science on this very issue, COVID-19 and influenza, a perfect storm, ? And we laid out exactly the challenges that you just so nicely summarized. and even to the extent of how do we get vaccine to our populations when we're worried about bringing people together with this COVID-19 situation. We urge strongly people be vaccinated for flu. We need to take as much of that off the table as we can. Surely we'd like to have a better flu vaccine than we do, but we have to do with what we can. So I refer people to the Science magazine article. Just go to the magazine Science and hit influenza or COVID and it'll pop up.
Dr. Osterholm, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Michael Osterholm with Conversations on Healthcare podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flitter. Next, a commentary by Mark Trahant.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant at the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a former journalism professor and a veteran reporter and editor. He's also a member of Idaho Shoshone Bannock Tribe. As the editor of the online publication Indian Country Today, he offers commentaries from a Native perspective. Today, his topic is a summer unlike any other.
Summer doldrums are the lazy, hazy days of summer when not much seems to happen. The world seems to slow down. In fact, the noun doldrums stems from the word dull. This summer is not likely to be dull. President Donald Trump is restarting his political campaign amid a national pandemic, and his first rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma last week started off in those doldrums. The protests were well organized and largely quiet, and the crowds supporting the president were far less than the Trump campaign expected. The president took to the stage. He defended Confederate statues and, by association, Christopher Columbus, and he used a racist description for the coronavirus itself. The president will travel to Phoenix this week and speak at a much smaller venue, so we won't yet know if Tulsa is an outlier or a representation of the campaign to be. Meanwhile, the pandemic continues on its course. The World Health Organization said the number of cases globally has topped 8.5 million and 150,000 daily cases, the most yet. The agency said this is a dangerous phase because people are tired of staying home and countries are eager to reopen their economies. Yet COVID-19 is still spreading fast and we are all at risk. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is a microbiologist and head of the World Health Organization. He called out the politicalization of the pandemic. He said, "The greatest threat we face now is not the virus itself. It's the lack of global solidarity and global leadership. We cannot defeat this pandemic with a divided world." I recently drove across the country and I saw this divided world at every freeway stop. In New Mexico, along I-40, signs warned to wear masks when in public. In other states, such as Texas and Arkansas, there were hardly any masks. This will be evident in Arizona this week. The city of Phoenix requires masks in public, but the mayor has already said that that rule will not apply to Trump's visit, where he will speak to a Students for Trump rally. No masks, 3,000 young people, a growing pandemic. What could go wrong? Let's hope for the summer doldrums. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion with poet Tim Murphy. His posthumous work is a finalist for the Midwest Book Awards. And June is Pride Month. We'll share another excerpt from Breaking Barriers. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Bismarck-based Basin Electric Power Cooperative is adding more solar and wind to its portfolio. Basin will be buying the output of a new solar power project being built near Baker, Montana, and will buy the power from a new wind farm to be built in northern North Dakota. Here's Basin's Andrew Buntrock.
We've had huge growth over the last decade, and so we've been able to fill that growth in with some renewables, affordably priced renewables, to include wind and solar. So as long as, you know, we're still seeing some growth, you know, we're filling that in with renewables and then also natural gas. All the while keeping a good mix to ensure that we've got good reliability for our customers, because we can't go all in on one. You know, you definitely need that all the above energy strategy.
Basin still has 42% of its electricity coming from coal, with renewables at around 23%. Minot State University is making some changes in its tuition model. It'll be before the Board of Higher Education later this month. Brent Winiger is Minot State's Vice President for Administration and Finance.
When the current model that we've been using for the last several years is first put in, it was designed to associate like online and distance education expenses and, you know, with the revenues and sort of put them out into a separate bucket. But with the growth of online, which is, you know, probably a quarter of our classes now, and the credits we generate are online, roughly, you know, that's gotten a little bit out of whack. And so the revenues now are outstripping the expenses, which is kind of interesting. And so now with this COVID-19 pandemic that we've got going, what's happening is we're anticipating even more classes will be going to online this fall.
So Winiger says the university decided to simplify things.
This basically makes a credit, no matter what you're taking, it's, you know, it's going to be an identical structure. And so that gives us more flexibility. You know, it puts the revenues and expenses all in the same bucket for everybody, and we can allocate as needed. It makes us more nimble and flexible in terms of how we put our operational budgets together. And it, you know, it's more transparent. It simplifies everything.
Winiger says it also makes it easier to explain to students and parents. And former University of Mary president Sister Thomas Welder has died at the age of 80. She was named president of what was then Mary College in 1978. She served until 2009. Her successor, Monsignor James Shea, attributes the growth at UMary to Sister Thomas's vision and tenacity. Shea says she can be described as having grace and grit.
In other words, she wasn't kind of a pushover, and she didn't believe that servant leadership meant that she should be a wilting violet who would just roll over when any wind blew. She knew that the wind can blow strong on our prairies, and that if you're going to make it, you have to stand tall and you have to be resilient. She was resilient like that, and Sister Thomas was a beautiful woman of grace and grit. That will be a legacy.
Sister Nicole Kunze is the prioress of Annunciation Monastery. She says people always remembered how personable she was.
Relationships were key to her. And that is why our alumni continue to come back. That's why she still had an office here on campus, because so many people kept looking for her and wanted to get back in touch with her. And the example she gave as a servant leader certainly will live on long past her.
Sister Thomas had recently been diagnosed with kidney cancer. She passed away early Monday morning. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The 30th Annual Midwest Book Awards will be announced Saturday. Among the finalists are three titles published by North Dakota State University Press. One of them is Hunter's Log, Volumes 2 and 3, by poet Tim Murphy, published posthumously. We visited with Tim in 2011 about his first volume in the Hunter's Log series. Today we share an excerpt of that conversation as he visits with Prairie Public's Director of Radio, Bill Thomas.
Tim, how did you come to put together a book of poetry about hunting?
I set out to become a poet when I was 17. In fact, I was graduated from Yale as Scholar of the House in poetry when I was 21. As soon as I started coming home, I got fairly serious about hunting. When I started breeding and training and hunting with black labs in my mid-30s, I started writing a lot of hunting poems. And I've often been asked what on earth I'm doing living in Fargo. And with due respect to the Fargo Opera Company, I answer, it ain't for the opera. North Dakota is one of the greatest places to hunt birds in the world. It's a passion in my life. So I just put my experience of meter and rhyme together with my experience as a field.
Now, these poems weren't written all as a set. These are poems that you've written over various times that are put together here?
Oh, yeah. The entire span is about 27 years. And the unusual thing about Hunter's Log is that unlike my other six books that have been published so far, it's not a snapshot in time. It gives the reader an opportunity to see me grow as a poet from the age of, say, 35 to age 60.
A book of poems about hunting is somewhat unusual, but also unusual about your work is the way that you use form. You are, as they say, a formal poet, which doesn't mean you wear a tuxedo, but that you work with meter and rhyme in certain established ways that are not as common as they used to be.
No, they're not as common as they used to be, although they're coming back strong. My tutor at Yale was Robert Penn Warren, who won three Pulitzer Prizes. He gave me a three-year tutorial, which basically consisted of memorizing 30,000 lines of poetry in classical Greek, in Anglo-Saxon, in French, and in English. And I simply fell in love with the rhythms and the music of the canon of world poetry. My own view is that of Robert Frost, that writing poetry without meter and rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. Or that of his progenitor, E.A. Robinson, who was asked why he didn't write free verse, and he said, "I write badly enough as it is."
Well, okay, so pick a poem and then tell us a little bit about the form that you use so that we'll be listening for it as you read it, and then read it for us. Would you do that?
Okay, well, I'm going to read Hunting on Thanksgiving, and the form is very simple. It is three stanzas of six lines each, and the rhyme scheme is AABBCC, so each stanza consists of three heroic couplets. Hunting on Thanksgiving. Thanks for my tall Norwegian hunting buddy. I love him best when his right hand is bloody from gutting out our birds. Thanks for the true friend you found me when I was 22. He flees from me, but I attach no blame to Alan, who would never clean my game. Thanks for the dog who frolics as I slog mud to my ankles through this flooded bog. Thanks for the pheasant stuffed into my vest, whose felling in these weeds was just a test of heart pounding and fouled lungs out of breath. Thanks for the priest who will attend my death. Thanks for the bird I missed, for Feeney's flush, the faint thunder of wings, breaking the hush of mass conducted in the open air. Thanks for pulling me back from the despair which might have lost me 1,800 days I have devoted to my Maker's praise.
We have to pause for a minute for the meaning of the poem. To focus on the form seems almost disrespectful to the work in a way, but in part because the form does not call attention to itself. You're not listening going like, ba-bum, 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 rhyme, ba-bum, 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 rhyme. It just happens and it flows so naturally in the poem. I mean, you are really good at using a form that seems to reinforce the meaning of the poem without, as I said, calling attention to itself excessively.
Yeah, the form has to be invisible and effortless. It takes a long time to learn how to do that. I mean, I started trying to write in meter and rhyme when I was 17, and the earliest poem that I've published in any of my books was written at age 25. And, you know, this despite memorizing 30,000 lines of poetry as a kid. But, of course, I'm no incandescent genius like John Keats. I mean, when Keats was my age, he'd been dead for 45 years, 35 years.
So that's a way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Of the things that you mentioned in this poem about hunting on Thanksgiving was the dog. And you have a whole section in the book about dogs.
Well, the dogs are all the way through the book.
Right. They're in almost every poem.
In almost every poem. I've been hunting since I was a kid, but I didn't start hunting with dogs until I was in my mid-30s. And these days, I would rather go afield without my gun than without my dog. Let me read Missouri Breaks. I am a trespasser on treeless ground, home to the sharptail and the furtive Hun, and here the tallest thing for miles around is a small hunter shouldering his gun. A blooded dog quarters the feral rye, and my body's long quarrel with my mind is silenced by a landscape and a sky legible as a Bible for the blind.
Besides dogs being present in almost all the poems, spirituality is present as well. And do you want to talk about that? I mean, you mentioned that hunting as preparation for your own death, that doesn't necessarily imply spirituality, but it strongly does. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, well, I fled the Catholic Church by the time I was a teenager and was dragged back kicking and screaming by the Holy Spirit about 6 years ago. So the spiritual element of the book is pretty much in the second half of the book, and that will be apparent to purchasers of Mortal Stakes and Faint Thunder as well. The circumstances of that were so strange. I was going to commit suicide because the farm was about $100 million underwater. My life insurance was the best answer to that problem. I was loading a shotgun, and a phone rang, and it was the valedictorian of my class at Yale. And he said, "Timothy, I just had a vision of you loading a shotgun, getting ready to blow your brains out, and I fear that you are in the gravest physical and spiritual danger." This was Francis Xavier McCarthy, who had been a great atheist philosopher then became a nutjob Catholic, which is a fair description of me these days. He brought me around. So essentially, I'm able to go back to all my old farming themes and all my old hunting themes, all my old mountaineering themes, but this time bring the Lord into it.
And have you revised your poems, or some of the older poems are as they were when you wrote them?
I haven't revised anything.
Yeah, okay.
No. There are some that I regret having written. I did a slam on St. Paul when I was age 26, which is in my first book, which I really regret having written. But these books are in libraries. There's nothing you can do about it.
Right, right. I think we have time for one more poem.
Okay, let's do a dog poem. My second dog was Elmwood's Maud Gunn. She was a puppy from my first dog, Elmwood's Dictynothea. Maud hunted for me for 12 years, and she lived for 14 years. Her vet, and the vet for all of my dogs, is Dr. Dan Treat. In my book, Set the Plowshare Deep, I referred to Dr. Treat as St. Francis of Fargo. And he was windsurfing in Baja, California. After his windsurf, he sat down in a bar next to a guy who bought him a beer and said, "What are you doing? Where are you from?" And Dan said, "Well, me, I'm from Fargo and I'm a vet." And the guy said, "Are you St. Francis of Fargo?" And this must have been the only guy who had read Set the Plowshare Deep. So in any case, we had to put Maud down, and this poem is entitled Huntress. Her first bird was a crippled mourning dove. She somersaulted down a ditch, head over heels in love, buttoned her bird, and bounded up the pitch. Her first drake dropped behind a refuge sign. Wriggling under the lowest wire, she swam a perfect line as though posting a proof of her desire. Her first goose gave her nose a nasty peck. Battered by its unbroken wing, she leapt to grab its neck and, growling, drag it back for me to ring. Her first loss was her superhuman ear. Hand signaled on each unmarked run she could no longer hear, whistling wingtips, even at last, the gun. At 14, she was walking into walls, fouling the carpet, losing teeth. Farewell to mallard calls and decoy spreads, wild roosters on the heath. To St. Francis of Fargo fell the chore, the Nembutal a gentle thrust to launch her from our shore. The last look in her fearless eye was trust.
Poet Tim Murphy from his book Hunter's Log. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks very much for having me.
Bill Thomas in a conversation with late poet Tim Murphy, author of Hunter's Log Volumes 2 and 3, which is a finalist for this year's Midwest Book Awards. Two other books published by the NDSU Press are also finalists, Still by Rebecca and Kenneth Bender, and Stringing Rosaries by Denise Lajimadier. Next, an excerpt from Breaking Barriers.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
When you take that social distancing walk or do chores around the house, I mean, you've got plenty of time for that, right? Put on your earbuds and immerse yourself in public radio content made just for you.
Hey, y'all, it's Sam Sanders, and welcome to NPR One.
Hourly newscasts from NPR and Prairie Public, your favorite podcasts, and your new favorite podcast. Plus, stories from Planet Money and Hidden Brain, coverage of the arts, and something we really need to be paying attention to these days, health and science. NPR One is personalized public radio content tailored to your interests, but you'll also hear up-to-the-minute news you need to know, like on the coronavirus.
That personalized balance is the heart and soul of NPR One.
It's just like the radio, but under your control. Download the NPR One app and listen.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. June is Pride Month, and today we have another episode of a podcast produced for the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project, Breaking Barriers, Harvesting LGBTQ Stories from the Northern Plains. In this excerpt, Jan Jorgensen visits with interviewer Daryl Hansen.
When did you discover you were not straight?
Well, I knew at the age of 14 that I was different. I didn't know what. And I was always a tomboy, but I was always attracted to men, and I married a man. So I didn't really realize that I was a lesbian until I was 29. And it was during the time I was married that I realized that, nope, I was a lesbian.
Growing up, do you remember any negative jokes, or did you have a feeling that being gay was wrong?
Yes, when I was 18 and I joined the Navy, I'll never forget this day. And my parents were older. My mom had me when she was almost 40, so if you can imagine that generation. Mm-hmm. This woman looked at me and said, well, you know, the only women that are in the military are either lesbians or whores. And that really stuck with me. Oh, my gosh. And then when I was 21, I remember telling mom about all these women softball players that they were lesbians. Mom always said, oh, you know, those lesbians, if they could just find a good man, they would probably change.
Doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way. No, it doesn't work that way.
Did you have, besides your mother's being homophobic, I mean, was the military also very homophobic? And
yes, this was in the 70s. So the 70s was a really tough time for gays and lesbians because it was always just a big witch hunt. If we didn't date men, then we were labeled as a lesbian. And the NIS would start investigating women. And women were getting kicked out all the time. So they really had to pretend that they had boyfriends. And so that was really hard. And so I guess I'm sort of glad I was straight during that time, because I know I probably would have gotten kicked out.
When you, at 29, how did you, this transformation you made, how did you feel about that? How did that affect you?
Oh, well, let's see. I was married to a man, and I was really a mess trying to figure out, okay, I'm going to have to leave my husband. And I almost committed suicide. It was so awful. I was drinking heavily. I just didn't know what to do. I mean, I hadn't finished my education. I didn't want to say I was a lesbian, but the woman I left him for just kind of helped me through that. But, oh, it was awful.
What was it that was hard to come to terms with? I mean, the religious part?
No, just the coming to terms was, here I was leaving my husband for a woman? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about being a lesbian. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, how am I going to support myself? So I just packed my truck up and I said, okay, I'm going, but I was terrified. He kept saying, what did I do wrong? Mm-hmm. And that was, 33 years ago, and he's never remarried. Mm. So it was very traumatizing for the two of us. I think it took me probably a couple years before I could actually say that I was a lesbian, because I didn't want to believe it. Mm-hmm. But the relationship I had with the woman was, yeah, it was great. I knew it was the right thing. So the fear of moving to North Dakota, being a lesbian, there was no rejection, and it's been that way ever since. Mm-hmm. And we're out to all the neighbors, and now I introduce my partner as my wife, and sometimes that takes a lot of guts.
It does. What challenges do you think the LGBTQ community faces?
I think the challenges that the young people face is acceptance. Some of them are so cute. They're so out there, and, you know, they'll vocally say, oh, I'm a lesbian, or they'll be holding their girlfriend's hands. And mm-hmm. sometimes I think they're going to have challenges with mm-hmm. older people. I was just at the VA a couple weeks ago, and this young woman sat down, and I don't know how it started, but she said, oh yeah, and I'm a lesbian. And I thought, oh, you're so brave to be able to just say that, you know. But I think the challenges are just, for us even, it's still acceptance and teaching people that that this isn't a choice.
Right.
So much can change, and we have to keep fighting for our rights and our equality.
Interviewer Daryl Hansen in a discussion with Jan Jorgensen from the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project. Dakota Datebook is next.
Georgia was one of the first states to reopen, but unlike Texas and Florida, the state is not seeing a surge in coronavirus cases reported. Some scientists believe testing problems might be hiding the true story.
The challenge with Georgia is that the data has been so inconsistent and lumpy.
The story behind the numbers on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Bill and Lana Augustat, in honor of their granddaughter Sophia Augustat's 11th birthday.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 22nd. In our diverse region of the country, one fact we can probably all agree on is that North Dakota enjoys an historical and essential partnership with agriculture. A small but vibrant example is the reception of the North Dakota Agricultural College's unique farm train in the month of June in 1910. When the Better Farming train pulled into the Davenport, North Dakota Railroad Station, it was met by throngs of interested North Dakotans. The Forum newspaper wrote that the day's crowd was large at 8 a.m. and grew to some 600 or 700 people packing themselves in throughout the day. The farm train featured cars displaying, instructing, and featuring the latest scientific information on agriculture. After the initial hour of the gathering, the attendees adjourned to a hall where they met a Mr. Willard representing the Northern Pacific Railroad. The railroad partnered with the NDAC by providing the train. The Agricultural College afforded two of its star professors to teach, advise, and mingle with the rural citizens. Professor Lawrence Waldron offered ag advice as well as his expertise on the type of trees needed on North Dakota prairies. Professor John Shepherd discussed clover and corn production. Both professors were early hires at NDAC and remain honored to this day with the buildings named for them, Shepherd Arena and Waldron Hall. In a number of states, farmers' institutes provided outreach to rural families through agricultural colleges. North Dakota Agricultural College was one of those participants. With the start of the Extension Division at NDAC in 1914, and in partnership with the state's Agricultural Experiment Station, NDAC staff helped run and teach the popular Farmers' Institutes. The cooperation between the MP Railroad and the campus led to many successful collaborations that allowed the campus to reach one of its goals, quote, to make the state its campus, unquote. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Steve Stark, I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. And just a reminder that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can always find a Main Street program right there at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, we'll share a special program from The Right Question, which features authors from the Western United States. Host and producer Sarah Aronson visits with Shonda Buchanan about her memoir, Black Indian. It's an exploration of her family's legacy as African Americans with American Indian roots. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.